Thanks, Pam. My name's Jason, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Jason.
I'm a grateful recovering addict. Every day these days, it seems like I'm given an opportunity to remember just how grateful I am and how blessed I am to be in recovery. I have a hard time thinking about the ninth step without thinking about my brother. And I don't want to spend a long time going into my history, but when I was 11 years old, going on 12 years old, our mother had died of a pretty nasty battle of cancer. And a couple of months after that, my brother got me high for the first time. And that started the journey. 15 years later, in 1986, actually it was 1985, I think, my brother was abstinent, attending meetings in another fellowship. And it was at his second wedding, the reception dinner, he came up to me and said to me, "You don't have to live your life like this anymore." And that was the first time anybody had confronted me about my using in a long time that I hadn't had some kind of a smart-ass remark. He planted the seed. And as I'm sure everybody in this room is aware, that, you know, when they're out there planting the seeds, when we talk about people planting the seed, a lot of times, you know, we think about that as like a subtle little thing, you know. But my addiction, my higher power wasn't sending me subtle little messages. You know, it's like even the people I partied with were saying, you know, when I get as bad as you, I'm going to stop using. It's like I was the worst case scenario active addict, you know. And I think I got a lot of those people scared when I stopped using. The deal though is that when I came into these rooms, I was really, really toxic. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't know what I was doing here. All I knew is that I was miserable and I wanted to die every day. And people took me by the hand and they took me to a detox, and then they took me to a rehab, and then from there I went to like a halfway house. And when I started going to meetings, my brother was out there, and he had been abstinent for a couple of years by that point, almost. And even as toxic as I was at the time, and clueless about the whole recovery thing and how this program worked, it was pretty obvious to me right away that he wasn't working much of a program, because he would say things about working the steps. And one of the things that he said about the ninth step in particular has always stuck in my mind is like, this was when I was sure there was going to be a problem with his recovery. He said, "Well, as far as them fucking ninth step people, man, I ain't making no amends to nobody, and they can all just go fuck themselves, and they shouldn't have been in my way." It's pretty obvious that with an attitude like that, he didn't stay in recovery very long. And he died of an overdose about 12 years ago. I don't know exactly when he started relapsing, but he didn't spend a whole lot more clean time, you know, after that. And he did, you know, all of the things that you do when you relapse. He stopped going to meetings, he didn't have a sponsor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that statement about the ninth step, for me, has always been the defining characteristic of the addict that is going to relapse and die. And the reason I always think about that when I think about the ninth step is because that is like one end of the spectrum. This is like, you know, that carrot and stick metaphor, that's the stick. This is what happens to you if you don't work steps. You die. And I can tell you, as somebody that tried to 12-step him for a long time and was probably the closest person to him that had any kind of a clue about what recovery was about, he died a really miserable death, and he died alone and in a lot of pain. But now it's time for the stick. That was the stick. It's time for the carrot. The carrot is to be found for me in this book, the It Works, How, and Why. This is my favorite book. It's a passage at the very end of step 9. As a result of working the 9th step, we are free to live in the present, able to enjoy each moment and experience gratitude for the gift of recovery. Memories of the past no longer hold us back, and new possibilities appear. We are free to go in directions we never considered before. We are free to dream and to pursue the fulfillment of our dreams. Our lives stretch out before us like a limitless horizon. We may stumble from time to time, but the 10th step gives us the opportunity to pick up ourselves and keep walking forward. Our higher power has given us an invitation to live, and we accept it with gratitude. Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to talk about here, is that there is a tremendous reward to be had, not just by staying clean, you know, not just working the first 3 steps, but working at your recovery and working on yourself. And I think it's very appropriate that that passage that has so much promise, it sort of like lays it out there for you. There is an incredible life to be had after you've worked these 9 steps. It makes a lot of sense to me that it's placed there in that point in this book, because I've always looked at the steps as sort of broken down into like 3 rough chunks. You know, the first 3 steps teach you how to stay clean on a daily basis. These are like the life raft that you need to cling to while you're coming to and becoming conscious again. And I don't know about you people, but I was one very toxic individual. When I came around these rooms, it took me a couple of years, at least a year, to detox completely. And I probably still wasn't really getting a clue for the first year and a half, 2 years. So the next chunk of these steps are the steps 4 through 9 for me. These are the steps that you start working on when you start dealing with the wreckage of your past and with the wreckage inside here and up in here. And that's the tough part. Learning how to stay clean sometimes, I think, is the easy part. It's having the courage to deal with the shit inside of yourself. That is the hard part. You know, courage isn't something we talk about a lot in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and it takes a lot of courage to stay clean and to work these steps and to be willing to recover. And I guess, you know, it's not like the courage that you see in those stupid old World War II movies that they show late at night, where the guy grabs and runs up the hill and attacks to save the battalion. It's not that. And it's not the kind of courage where you run out and pick up a baby in front of an oncoming car or something. It's not that. It's a much quieter inner courage. The courage to face the demons that live inside of me is what I'm talking about. And so that kind of brings us to this part of the journey is the 9th step stuff, which is getting right to the point where, you know, you hopefully your sponsor has gotten to the point where he said, yeah, it's time for you to start making amends. And it's usually not a good idea to make a lot of amends before you've gotten through your 4th, 5th, and 6th, and 7th steps and talked about it with your 8th step and your 9th step, and your sponsor said, yeah, it's time. There might be a couple of times, might happen to you like it happened to me, where I had opportunities arise where it was obvious to me it was the right time before I was formally working the ninth step. And I was able to make a couple amends at those times. Most of them were well received, and a couple of them really were not. You know, where I had my inventory taken for me, and rather than walking into this step with humility, I came away from it humbled. And that's, you know, a whole different experience. The thing about my experience with the ninth step is when I was coming up on working my eighth and ninth step, is I changed sponsors. My sponsor moved to Brunswick, Maryland, which is like way the hell up the Potomac River. It's, you know, a long distance call and a long call and a long drive, and it wasn't somebody I was going to be seeing in meetings on a regular basis. So in the middle of that process, I changed sponsors, which in a way I think is sort of a good thing, because it meant I had a chance to go over my eighth and ninth step with two sponsors, not one. And it was also one of those kind of experiences where I was sort of humbled also. And the reason I bring that up is because there's somebody on my amends list that is, well, not just somebody, but a few people that are definitely in the category of the best way I can make amends to these people is stay the hell away from them and stay out of their lives. And there is no safe way for me to go in there and open up that can of worms without making things so much more worse than, you know, what am I going to say? Oh, hey, buddy, I'm sorry I was sleeping with your wife right in front of your face. I hope that didn't bother you, you know. And that, you know, the reaction you might get from that could be described in a police report. But you know what? When I was using, I was a pretty slimy person. And that's something I needed to, I often say about myself, is that when I got into these rooms, I needed to stick with the winners and stay away from the slimy people. And the problem was is that I was the slimiest person I knew. And that's why I went to a lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor and paid attention for a change. But to get back to the ninth step is, you know, there were several people on that list. And it's not okay for me to open up that ball of wax. And the cool thing about it is the sponsor I had that moved to Brunswick, he pretty much told me, you know, that was the situation. And when I got a new sponsor, I guess it was about a year later, went through it again, and he pretty much said, yeah, that's probably a pretty good idea. And the harmonious thing about it, is that, you know, it's one of those resonance things in recovery. He had something very similar, a very similar thing going on in his life, you know, on his amends list, is I did. It's kind of, you know, in some ways, it's a very sad feeling inside of me. It's kind of depressing to stop and think back that, you know, there are people that are out there that I've hurt so badly, the best thing I can do is just stay away from them and never show my face again. There's a lot of guilt and shame associated with that. The good thing is that I'm not that person anymore. You know, I'm not a person that would sleep with somebody else's wife. I'm not somebody that would do that anymore. And I guess, you know, that sort of leads into the living amends kind of thing. Some of my most important amends have been living amends, not financial amends, not walking up to somebody and saying, I'm sorry for doing this. The most important amends I think that I've been able to make in recovery is staying clean 18 years. is, you know, not being out there doing crimes all the time. And you know, the bottom line is, if I'd been out there this long, I'd probably be dead, because, you know, I was about a week away from being a homeless guy living in a car when they took me to the treatment center. And it would have been somebody else's car, too, because I didn't have one of them anymore either. You know, the living the amends part was when I came into these rooms, I had a child that I had more than likely fathered by another person. This was part of what I'm talking about, was, and the mother of that child made it very, very clear to me that she did not want me to be the father of that kid, which sort of tells you what kind of person I was when I was out there using. And part of that amends process was trying to be a better father to the daughter that I ended up adopting. There was, you know, a sister I had that passed away. She was killed by a drunk driver. God, I don't know. It's like almost 19 years ago. You know, we were, you know, typical brother-sister. We fought like cats and dogs, and I was meaner than hell to her. You know, especially since we didn't have but this much parental supervision at home. I was, you know, like the only one paying attention to her at home, and, you know, I wasn't prepared for that, but, you know, I still felt guilty as hell about the fact that this was a six-year-old kid when her mother died, and I treated her meaner than hell. And the bad part about it was, is I was the only person paying attention to her at all. There wasn't anybody paying any attention to her. The only affection this kid got was me being an asshole to her. So, you know, being a better father was part of that amends. And, you know, I haven't always been the greatest father. I'm sure my daughter will be more than happy to tell you about some of the times I've been a jerk. There was a period in my recovery where I stopped going to meetings mostly for about a year, year and a half. I was going like maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month. And here's a surprise, I got to become that same old asshole. I was pretty much just an angry, pissed off person all the time. So this is, you know, something I don't recommend, is not going to meetings. I don't do that anymore. There were times when I wasn't the best father in the world, but I worked hard at it. There were times I wasn't always the best husband in the world, but I worked hard at it. One of the most important parts of my amends, I think, was making amends with my father. He and I had a serious blowout when I was, about 6-7 years clean. Had his part in that, and we didn't talk for about three years or so, and it was eating me up inside. I couldn't sleep at night. I was, you know, just miserable all the time. I was going to meetings all the time. I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing for my recovery, and I was still miserable. I finally broke down, and I talked to my sponsor about it. Now, how bad is it that you actually have to talk to your sponsor about it? And here's the kicker. As he listened to me spill out this huge vomit of just angst and pain and rage and bullshit and all of the stuff that I was all worked up about, and he had, like, one question for me. He said, "Are you ready to forgive him?" And it just absolutely floored me. It just, you know, totally floored me that I should forgive him. It just, like, this. And it was the perfect thing to say. It was, it just totally stunned me. And that was you know, another journey that I had to make is, it was probably the most important journey in regards to the ninth step, I think, is that I had to learn by going through all of this pain and aggravation that I went through, is that I need to forgive in order to be forgiven. And more importantly, a lot of times with the people we need to make amends with, this is like a two-way street. You know, their side of the street might be dirty too. And what I had to learn out of that is, I don't worry about his shit. I don't care what his side of the street looks like. I have to worry about what's going on inside of Jason. I can't worry about my dad's stuff or anybody else's stuff. I had to worry about what was going on inside of me. And for me to progress with my life, what I needed to do was forgive this person that had harmed me and then step forward and ask to be forgiven. And he forgave me. Here's another humbling experience. He never said, "I'm sorry." He probably never will. He's, you know, 78, 79 years old or something like that. He's like, I don't know, he's like the Energizer Bunny or something. I don't think he'll ever stop ticking, you know. At least I hope not, because I suspect that when he gets to be, you know, really, really old and incapable of taking care of himself, he's going to be really cranky. But, you know, that's something scary I've got in the future, too, is I have friends talking about having to put their parents into homes and stuff, and I'm not looking forward to that. I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic again. He never said, I'm sorry. He really doesn't think that he ever did anything wrong. And that was, you know, a lot of my family history is, in my family, don't ever, ever, ever admit that you were wrong. Don't ever do that. That was like the cardinal sin. And for me, you know, a very important part of my recovery is knowing when I'm wrong and admitting it. So that was another little thing is, you know, I kept waiting for that I'm sorry also, and it never came. And I just had to learn how to accept that also. And, you know, the good news is today my father and I have a pretty good relationship, you know. I think probably as good as it's ever going to be or as good as it's ever been. And that's, you know, again, part of the promises of these programs. This program is so incredible because it's not just about staying clean. It's about having good relationships with people that you thought were just going to never talk to you again. It's about getting your family back. It's about getting your life back. It's about getting promises back, dreams back. It's about getting so much more than you could possibly ever expect to have given to you. All you have to do is have the courage to work on yourself. And, you know, I got to tell you, my experience has been is that I very rarely went out of my way to start working on myself on purpose. You know, I'm a good addict. I do everything the addict way, and that means that I won't do anything unless my ass is on fire and, you know, the old shit is totally clawed up so badly that it looks like, you know, the cat went zoned out on methamphetamine and catnip. You know, that's just the way addicts are, man. We don't let go, and we don't work on stuff unless we have to. But you know what? It's changing for me. Very slowly, but it's changing for me. The last fourth and fifth step I did with my sponsor, I actually looked forward to doing it. Because I knew that at the end of that journey, there was going to be a payoff. And that's, I guess, the glory of that little passage at the end of the ninth step is, at the end of this journey, there is going to be a huge reward. Please don't focus on the fear that you're going to get rejected when you walk up to somebody to make your amend. Please don't get delayed and sidetracked by that self-centeredness Because, and that's what fear is, I really believe, is fear is thinking about yourself. Remember just what, you know, you've learned through all of these years of doing your recovery and your program. The more you start walking outside of yourself and doing service work and helping other addicts, the better you feel about yourself. And I guess that's about all I got to say. I'm going to shut up and let this guy have at it. Watch it.
Thank you so much for sharing, Jason. And now I'd like to give you Walston B.
Hi, family. My name is Walston. I'm an addict. It's real good to be here. I'd like to thank the program committee for this convention for asking me to be a part of this workshop. Jason said, what was it? Methamphetamine and catnip. Yeah, I mean, I got to keep coming. You know, and we're definitely more alike than different. A lot of Jason's comments, you know, I could relate to right down the line. I also want to invite anybody that might be in the Central Maryland Greenbelt area on Monday night at 7 to come out and join me at what I feel is the best home group. It works high and wide. We have a greeter at the door, right? And we have a lot of love to share. So please come out and share with us recovery. Let me see what else. I want to thank Russell for riding up here with me. And Robert and Russell for staying in the same room with me. This process here for me has been one that has opened doors that I never dreamt, never imagined. And so the theme of this whole convention, Lost Dreams Awaken, is very significant in that I've had dreams that really were put to sleep, awakened. And I'll try to touch on some of them if I can. I heard Jason talking about getting off the topic. Well, don't hold me if I get off the topic. Please don't judge me if I get off the topic. And I think I'm in a room with people just like me, so I'm going to share my experience. And we'll see where we go with that. So I just might get off the topic. My first attempt at a ninth step took place when I had 1 year clean. I was at a podium much like this. It's my first year anniversary, Charles Houston. And my family was sitting in the front row. My cousin was there, and my mother, and my stepfather, and my aunt. And after my speakers had spoke, Garvin brought me a chip, as I recall, and a bottle of cider. I'll never forget that. But they didn't have the cake, so I was really messed up about that. The room was full of people, and my gratitude went out the window when they didn't have the cake. But when I had the opportunity to share, I started to take the opportunity to apologize to my mother for all the money I'd stole, all the times I'd called her to come get me out of jail, and to my stepfather for the diamond ring he gave me that I gave to my man on Queen Street for that bag of dope. And, you know, and I got to my cousin, and I said, for that 9mm of yours that I took, I have, you know, I didn't rob anybody with it. I gave it to the crack boy, you know, and that's what I did. You know, I took it with the intent to rob, but when you're on crack, don't act like y'all know what I'm talking about. Anymore. When you're geeking, you're geeking. Ain't no robbery going to take place unless it's you getting robbed. So I gave his 9 away. And for a little bit of crack, and that was my, you know, my first attempt at amends making. Later in the process, I guess it was about 6 months later, I got a sponsor because that's what y'all said do, And I started working with this guy. He started saying things like meetings alone wasn't enough, that you had to show up at his house. And I remember he'd say, well, meet me at 6:30 or meet me at 7, and we'd be sitting out front of his house. Notice I said we, because I didn't do that by myself. I had to have a crew that I traveled with to keep me in that herd. And we'd sit out front, and it would be 7 if we were meeting at 7, and he hadn't arrived, and I'd start looking at my little timepiece, and 7:15, he still hadn't arrived, and I said, shit, this shit looked mighty familiar. Now, of course, if it was the dope man, yeah, I'd be waiting. But all of a sudden, I'm in a hurry. I'm impatient. This process is just that. It's a process. And I waited, and I started interacting with this guy, and he started helping me understand the significance of simple things like water and the significance of it spiritually. Introduced me to 3 spiritual principles embodied in water, being a cleanser, a healer, and a life sustainer. And in the morning, I would, in my mind's eyes, I began to clean up to meet the day. I should understand that that would also be an introduction to clean up the inside as I moved into prayer to meet the day. And I started doing these things without fail because by the time I had gotten to this point in my life, I was 41. I'm now 54. You do the math. But I was just right for Narcotics Anonymous. I mean, I was beat down. My hands were about the size of boxing gloves. I was injecting dope in every part of my body. I had about 3 teeth up top. I love doing that. So y'all can see my NA grill, right? I remember my early meeting, early in my process, a lady came to bring a message to a meeting wherever I was at, and I was in the back, and I had my 3 teeth. And she shared that, and I said, that bitch talking about me. She was telling her story. So I got my... So if you ain't here without your grill right, just keep coming. But I started getting with this guy and started, you know, recognizing the importance of being disciplined about the pursuit of these principles. Because my disease is really about me being wrapped up in me, consumed with what I think and what I feel, what I want, and why y'all not doing what I need you to do. You know, and when I come to understand through the process of going through 1 through up to 9, that in fact what I need to do is kind of deny self, to start beginning to renunciate my desires. That is the way to spiritual growth. And so I was disciplined about that to the extent that I was willing to, at a point, get to my 3rd step. And I love the analogy that I like to use of getting married for the 3rd time, because the first 2 times I was drunk. I was insane, and I got married out of very selfish motives. And, you know, the woman's brother had a house I could go run, and, you know, all that little crazy stuff. And the third wife, I loved her, to the extent that I understood love at that time. And so I got engaged to her, and I began to nurture that relationship. And that's basically what I did with my higher power in step 3, was I got engaged to my higher power. And I started to try to do the next right thing for the next right reason. Started to try to live by some integrity. Because I always live by those codes. We got a high works out there. Right? We got GSR out there, right? And secretary, chairperson, all that. You know, and so I learned how it works out there real well. Played the game for a long time till it almost killed me. And by the grace I got here, and I heard y'all talking about how it works, and the bottom line was I needed to kind of turn my thinking and my behavior over to something other than my stupid ass. Because I was going to die operating on what I thought and what I felt. It wasn't about what you feel, Austin. What you feel is what is killing you. Because I didn't want to feel. I used to my feelings. Every feeling I used to my feelings in recovery. So I have to recognize that a feeling ain't a fact unless I react. But the feeling will pass. And so I started hearing this kind of stuff, and I started to try to digest and live by some integrity, something I know nothing about. Try to practice some humility, and I'm all consumed with me, so I'm going to practice humility. Well, just remember your story. You've been, when the boy said, go get me a knee-high fries, ketchup, and put salt on there, no pepper, and hurry up about it, Slim. I might break you off a little something. Yeah. Or when you, yeah, great. And you come back with a strawberry. Oh, man. I'm talking about being humiliated. See, so I understand the difference between humiliation and humility. I practice it because I've been humiliated and I don't want to go back there. I practice it because, see, these principles are something that I learned to appreciate because, as my sponsor says, the Grim Reaper was near. And I recognized it. And I didn't want to die that way. So I went on and did some writing and stuff because, you know, I'm a real intellectual addict. And I would stand on the corner, some of those corners of Central Avenue and Southern or 14th and U. And I'd have my post because that was my, I operated like that. I'd carry a post with me. You know, not because I was going to read it, but I was an entrepreneur. I'd have jewelry that I would convince you was real, like Andy's gold chains. And I'd drop it in my newspaper, and I'd walk around with that stuff and flash, and you might want to do something. And after I got a shot of dope, I might sit down and read something out of it and resume the conversation with you about how to solve the national debt between nods. Y'all told me early on this was not an intellectual exercise. As a matter of fact, you can't make intellectual sense out of spiritual matters. Don't try. So I began to just understand that what I needed to do was keep putting one foot in front of the other because, see, we talk real good. See, but it's, what are you doing? It's an action program. And so putting pen to paper was real. See, somebody here right now thinks my name is Ralston. Somebody thinks my name is R-A-L-S-T-O-N. It's W-A-L-S-T-O-N. And I say that because if you see that visual imprint, that's just what happened in 4 for me. I was able to see the patterns in my life with the help of a sponsor in 5, how they unfolded, how I moved through life based on my self-centeredness. That was really the core of my disease. Man wrapped in self is a mighty small package. And I was so consumed with me. Me, 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 me. All about me. And I had to kind of start to move away from that and start to move towards a power that could help me with me. I thought I just had a problem with dope. Yeah, that brought you here, but that ain't the problem, Austin. You the problem. And I know that 10 years into the process, going into a locker room to work out, I opened the locker and there was a $10 bag of crack at the bottom of the locker, and I heard y'all, if you don't pick it up, you won't get high. And I picked it up. Didn't use it, but I'm just talking about the disease I live with. So I had to be vigilant about this process because I want to get better. I mean, 10 years into the program, I want to get better. 13 years now into the program, I'm still trying to get better. And there are people on my list I haven't gotten to. But there's so many miracles that have happened that I need to share with y'all before I run out of time. But 6 was important because I had to kind of recognize that what I went through was what I was supposed to go through to become who I'm becoming. The same God that brought me in is the same God that allowed me to stay out there. I'm talking about the God of my understanding. See, paradoxes are important for me to recognize today in my life. And because of being near death, I can recognize just the simplicity and appreciate breathing. Water. You know, a smile, a hug, an excuse me, a thank you. Things that have become foreign in our society. You know, so I practice it in spite of what they might do on the streets. You know, sometimes I'm successful. Sometimes I do like my wife say, run over in the car and look at them. Don't do that, honey. They might be strapped. You know, I'm getting better. I'm not perfect. The steps make you careful. Not perfect. So I keep pursuing them, and I recognize in 7 how easy it is for me to kind of become a creature of comfort. You know, I've been around here for a minute. You got a house now. You got 2-3 cars, stock, bond, you know. And so I don't think I'll go to the meeting tonight, Jason. Yeah, I think I'll just kick back. I got six remotes right here beside me. That's right, and I got them beside my recliner and my big screen. Yeah, so the seventh step helped me kind of recognize how I will compromise my recovery when I'm confronted with material gain over spiritual matters. I'll opt for the material every time. Give me the Gators, Gyron. You know, but this program say, well, you might want to rethink that sometime, Austin. See, it helped me get right sized up in here. See, what I'm trying to illustrate is that the journey to get to nine was one of getting right sized, because I can't start trying to forgive nobody or straighten out nothing, the wreckage of my past, if I ain't straightened out my raggedy ass. See, my sponsor helped me understand that I didn't need to go on my eighth step list. They say the people you harm, not your ass. Now, of course, the literature also says if you want to be on your list, that's fine. See, I recognize that the steps are personal. Salvation is personal. See, and I had to become creative with recognizing how I can get freed up in here. I can get so tied into, a little box that I can't find my way to move closer to the Creator. And when, in fact, what the steps are is a process of moving the stuff that's blocking me from the grace. The grace got me here, and the grace is what's going to keep me here. I found a way to leave, not intending to. And so it's real important for me to keep recognizing how important humility is. But I'm so arrogant. I want to put some shit on. I thought I'd put this on today, y'all, because, y'all know what that is. It's a monkey. Yeah, I had him on my back for so long, I thought I'd try to keep him in front of me tonight. Yeah, I'm talking about my process of how I have to use my sixth sense that I begin to develop as a result of, trying to just get developing some character, standing up and looking the world in the eye. I feel myself getting a little better now, and I'm not allowing myself to get so swayed and out of my lane, so to speak. And so when I make my list, I put the people down there that I recognize quickly, moms, all the folk that were immediate. And I got to a place on my list where I didn't have the name, because I abandoned her and her mother at birth across country. I went to college in Oregon, and I played ball out there, and I fathered this child, and I saw her be delivered, and I left and returned to the East Coast. So I put down baby, and in parentheses, put up for adoption. When in fact, I didn't even put up for adoption. I abandoned both of them. And I need to say that because I need to hear how cruddy a guy I am when I'm on it. And I returned here, and as the process would unfold, I just shared with you, I remember I had 5-6 years clean, I think, and I was on the phone talking to my grand sponsor about feelings of inadequacy, about not being able to get gifts for my children that lived in the immediate area because, I'm this recovering guy now. I'm supposed to have all this, I'm supposed to be able to take care of some stuff. And he was helping me, and the little beep came. And y'all know the beep means click or you blow. And see how quick, I wasn't going to click because I'm getting this help I need. And the second beep came, and y'all helped me raise my consciousness a bit. And because I didn't want to, it was like, that could be your wife. That could be anyone that needs you. I took the time to say, Tom, hold on. And I clicked over. And I said, who is it? And they said, is this Walton Balburn? I said, who? I said, you want Walston Barber? They said, yeah. I said, well, you got him. They said, well, this is a private investigator. I said, oh, no. Wrong number. No. They said, listen. You have a child that wants to meet you. And I about dropped the phone. Yes. And every time I share this, the feeling, I revisit the feeling. That's what's so powerful about coming in a room with people like you sharing your experience. It's all I got. This ain't no textbook. This is my experience. And if I hadn't been working on me, I wouldn't have been in my house with a telephone bill, much less the telephone. Right. to get the call. And I got the call, and I said, she said, she don't want nothing from you. She just wants to meet you. The tears started to flow. The lady on the other end down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she was calling from, started to cry. She said, "You're such a prince," and gave me the number, and I called her, and we started. This young lady, because she was 25 at that time, I think, had gone to my junior college in Oregon and talked to my football coach, had gone through all the phone books in D.C. I mean, talking about she was in pursuit of where she come from. And I didn't have the wherewithal, the conviction to be a man to even, you know. But when I was doing my eighth step, I was on a ninth step, talking about I'd never get to do anything in this area. But see, my God, my God, his infinite wisdom, my little finite mind could have never imagined this unfolding. That's why it's so important for me to just kind of keep putting one in front of the other. The evidence of this process of me working on me just continues to blow me away. That's why it ain't hard for me to do what y'all asked me to do, because I ain't where I was. And I ain't forgot where I came from. What do you think it's like laying on the floor with your thumb in your mouth trying to get a vein up in your neck for somebody to inject some narcotics in it, and you're not even sure if it's dope? I don't want to go back there. So the young lady flew in that Christmas, and she came to BWI Airport, and I had gotten pictures of her, but they were childhood pictures. Her adoptive parents had sent me pictures, and I'm standing on in the waiting area waiting for her to come down the gangplank. And when she came down, I saw her mother's Mexican, and so her hair was long and wavy, and she's fair complexion, but she got this joint right here. The nose, Jason. I saw the nose. I was like, what I saw, what I connected with was her spirit. I said, she didn't say nothing. She was as far away from me as Ron. Like, that's it. It's no words to describe that. And we started a relationship, and she moved on that New Year's Eve to Atlanta to bond with another child that I abandoned, my oldest son in Atlanta. And then she made a decision to relocate from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Atlanta. Got engaged to a guy of Jamaican descent who was in the Air Force, and then invited me to a wedding in a Southern Baptist church in Atlanta, Georgia, where her white adoptive parents were, the Jamaican in-laws were, and my black ass was. What I'm talking about is how Narcotics Anonymous will weave you back into the fabric of society if you allow it to. Let me be in the wedding. I mean, you know, I had an opportunity at that time to make amends as best I could to her mother, who I hadn't seen in over 30 years, at the wedding, at rehearsals and stuff. Didn't shed a tear until her first dance on a Bob Marley tune. Couldn't hold back the floodgates. Cried like a baby. And it was all right. They say, dance like nobody's watching in here. Get freed up in here. Get in where you fit in. See, this thing is about life and death. My mother right now is 78 years old. She was the first on my list. And there's no way I could repay her. But today, she and I are the guardian of the same cousin whose pistol I told y'all about. Because his mother died. Who used to be the one that would bail me out of jail all the time? I'm talking about how the amends works creatively if you allow it to. So I'm parenting my mother, who's helping me be the guardian of my cousin. You follow me? He's mentally challenged. Now they tell us the other day that, Walston, you got to go in there and get his money. Because I've been letting him keep his money, William. They said, no, you got to get his money. I'm the guardian and conservator. $300,000 home that my people got that he in with my mother. You got to run that. I let them keep it. I don't want to do. No, you on the papers. It's your responsibility. Now, I share that because his resistance, this man worked for 30 years in the government, mentally challenged. Your intelligent ass couldn't keep a job. But now you got to run the business. I don't want to, God. Well, step up, son. It didn't ask you what you wanted. Do you want to get freed up in here? Move towards the resistance. The thing you most least like to do is probably the thing you most likely need to do. Anything that brings me to my knees is good. And so the paradoxes of life have unfolded for me in a way where lost dreams are being awakened. And it's no way possible that I could use this form to adequately verbalize that. But I'm trying. Because I have experiences in this process that have gotten me freer than I ever dreamt possible. I mean, you know, I had a guy, I'll tell you one amends I did do before I was ready. Yeah, I'll offer you this. If they really wanted to catch Bin Laden, all they got to do is put the IRS on his ass. Oh, they get their man. They get their man. See, I got an uncle that I don't claim. His name is Sam. And he showed up before I was on the ninth step. Yeah. And again, having attempted to work on some discipline, I was able to make an agreement and start to pay, you know, and get that behind me. Direct amends, my father died, and I was the one that had to take him off of life support. I never grieved his death. I never really told him, you know, that I was sorry, but sorry, I think our basic text talks about how we, you know, how many times have our people heard us say we're sorry? We already know you're sorry. I used to go with my mother's man, I'd sit around, I heard my sponsor say the same thing one time about, you know, I'd sit around and say, how you doing? I'm fine. Well, how's that program, them classes you're going to? And my mother would start moving around the house, getting little canned goods and shit, putting it in a bag. Sit down, start writing a check. How much do you need? And you do like this. I don't need no money. Smiling like a mug on the inside. Yeah. See. Well, today I'm doing stuff for them. Today I'm doing stuff. My father. The indirect amends I did was I wrote him a letter, and I read it at his graveside. You know. We have to be creative about this process and ways to get this thing done. And my ninth step has been one of me trying to make an amends. Amends, by definition, is, in fact, trying to make it right, to amend, to just set it right. And some of the things I've described to y'all this evening, I could never make right. But what I did do was I took the hammer out of folks' hand. See, Jason mentioned that we sweep our side of the street off. I have to get freed up enough to be able to look the world in the eye today. I never did that before I got to Narcotics Anonymous, Andy. I was always plotting and planning, and the sneaky part of me was eating me up. And so today, because I'm not sneaky and conniving and can look the world in the eye, as a direct result of steps 8 and 9, I've taken the hammer out of people's hands. I've gone to children who, in fact, I made amends to, who still act like, well, you're just my friend, because I was never their father. But it's all right, because I can be the father that they allowed me to be today. I can be there for them. It's not important. What's important is that I'm not being held bondage by self. The dope is not my problem if I don't pick it up. But when I'm defective, I need a reason to go use something to make me feel better. I'll use you. And so the program has kind of helped me just get better is what I'm trying to say. You know, I got more work to do, a lot more work to do, but work ain't hard. Boss ain't me. I'm having a ball in recovery. They say it's like sex. If you ain't having fun, you ain't doing it right. That's my story. I'm sticking to it, y'all.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, baby. Thank you.